Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Matthew Wright, who is Assistant Professor of Government at Biola University. You might have remembered a piece he did for us back in the May 2018 issue called Rights in Common. As a professor of government, he is something of a theorist of the public square, and his new book is entitled A Vindication of Politics on the Common Good and Human Flourishing. It's from the University Press of Kansas, and that's going to be our topic for today. Professor Wright, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and begin, jumping right into the book. I mean, maybe I should say that this came out of your dissertation. I noticed that it was close to your dissertation, which you earned at the University of Texas a few years ago.
Yes. That's right. That's right. So the foundation of it was the dissertation. It was significantly revised and expanded. Actually, I made an argument in the dissertation that I felt like was suitable and did the job, but at the same time I wasn't quite satisfied with where I ended up. So I kept working on it and ended up with an argument ultimately that I was much more satisfied with, and that's in the book.
The book is out, which means you get tenure.
That's right.
And you're in place, and life will be good for a long, long time.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm hoping.
Okay. Now, you know, you say early in the book, you refer to, quote, the basic question. And the basic question you phrase as, is a society's political common good a constituent of full human flourishing, not merely a means to this end? What is that question about?
Yeah, it is asking the question: Is politics something that, in its nature, that we seek for its own sake? So you can think of something like the family. It's a kind of association that if someone were to go through life without a family. Whereas they might be able to, you know, to make do, get along okay, but without that kind of support, affection, connection to those around them, we would say they're missing something that's really important to what it means to be a social being.
So if you grow up, I mean, the family is more than just an instrument of producing happy individuals.
Right. Yeah. There's something about life within the family that draws out what it means to be a social being and cultivates particular virtues that are intrinsic to sociability, our human social capacity. If you don't have the chance to develop those, cultivate those within the context of the family, you're missing something really important. And the question about politics is there something about politics that's analogous to that? Or do we engage in politics because we need things like defense, we need things like utilities and so forth, but nothing about the association itself that we want for its own sake?
So a strong individualism, maybe some versions of classical liberalism or libertarianism, would really focus upon individual flourishing, and the political worlds, the organizations that you're part of, really become subordinate to your personal achievement and growth. I mean, I'm sure I'm oversimplifying, but roughly true?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's also often the case that associations of civil society, like the family, like religious groups, can become subordinated to the individual itself. I mean, to the individual, him or herself. So one of the questions I'm asking is, not just what's the relationship between the individual and the political community or the state, but what's the relationship between the family, the church, universities, all the voluntary associations that populate civil society, how do they relate to the political community, and what do they contribute to human flourishing?
Wouldn't have it impressed, you know, just an average American around 19, well, maybe, actually, maybe this hyper-individualistic route goes back to much of the Anglo-American tradition back a few hundred years. Is that right? The Henry David Thoreau walking out to the woods, right?
Living on
his own.
Yeah, no, that's right, and it's a much disputed topic in understanding the American founding and the conception of what it is for us to be we the people. What's the nature of the common good, and was the American project fundamentally polluted by a kind of autonomous individualism that didn't allow, you know, that conceived of the common good as merely conveniently overlapping interest, or did they have a broader conception of the common good rooted that required something like virtue and drew more on the classical tradition? Those questions are there at the founding, and as you know, Patrick Deneen's book "Why Liberalism Failed" has generated a lot of conversation about this.
And you clearly come down on the side of politics is actually constituent of full human flourishing.
I think it is naturally oriented. And the telos, to use an Aristotelian term, the telos of politics is to cultivate human capacities and lead to human flourishing. Yeah, and I'm interacting with some contemporary natural law theorists, predominantly John Finnis, who recently retired from the University of Oxford. He's also at Notre Dame, but he advanced a really detailed, nuanced kind of reinterpretation of Thomas Aquinas, to say that not only as a normative matter, but as an interpretive matter, Thomas Aquinas took the common good to be limited and instrumental. Finnis's view has been persuasive among a lot of natural law theorists, and so his work was kind of the springboard into my project. And I attempt to provide an account of why it is that political association is intrinsically valuable.
You mentioned in chapter two the familial good. What is the familial good?
Right. Yeah. And I do this on the way, as I mentioned before. So part of the project is to understand the relationship between political association, and the associations of civil society. So part of the argument is to focus on sub-political associational goods. And so I choose to focus on the family. And then even with that, you have to ask the question, well, how do you give a full account of the familial good in one chapter? You know, do you focus on the relationship of spouses, relationship of siblings, parent, child, the affective relationship, moral education? So what I did was I chose to focus on the nature of education, primarily moral education in the family. Thomas Aquinas, when he's talking about the basic inclinations that we have in human nature, that are kind of the fundamental starting point to understanding the character of the natural law, he identifies we have a basic inclination not only to procreate and have children, but in fact to educate them. So I take that to be one of the fundamental strains of understanding the character of the familial association and describing what the familial good is.
And you raise a contrary point about familial inequality. What is familial inequality?
Yeah, I'm getting there at the it's the fundamental, and depending on how you look at it, you take it as a problem or something with a lot of possibility. The difference in maturity between parents and children. So this is something I talk about the concerns that the ancients had with the family. But then also the concern that modern liberal theorists have with the family. And that tends to be focused on, for modern liberal theorists, on the imbalance in the relationship between parent and child. And so you have the concern that, the argument's made.
Do some liberals believe that the parent-child relationship is a case of inequality and that we must do something about that?
Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Absolutely. There's a.
Did these people have kids?
I assume so. I assume some do, and some you think. I don't see how that's possible.
Matthew, I believe there is an inequality between parent and child, and my child always wins.
Right. Yeah. No, it's the the concern is if you have this relationship that's fundamentally unequal, then what's going to happen? And Amy Gutman in her book Democratic Education says that the purpose that parents have in educating their children is simply to produce replicas of themselves. So a parent enters into that relationship just trying to kind of stamp the soul of their children with their own values, their own understanding of the world. And so that creates a problem, she argues, in cultivating the kind of person that you need to function effectively in a democratic society, someone who's able to think and reason autonomously. And so pretty much all of the liberal theorists will acknowledge the family is an important association insofar as it provides the emotional support that we need. So there's a lot of affective good there. But when it comes to cultivation of rational capacities, this is where it entirely breaks down, and parents are most interested in kind of overriding the natural inclinations of their children and creating little replicas of themselves.
I have to say, Matthew, that parents who want to create replicas of themselves very often end up creating forms of rebellion. Often the opposite of what they want. I mean, I think it was Colin Moran who said once with us at lunch here at First Things that Jung believed that children often grow up to be the things that their parents really wanted themselves to be. And weren't for whatever was, but my point being that the parent-child relationship, it seems, is much more complicated than replication.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think so definitely. And, I think it's a fundamental mistake, to understand the family. And this is the primary thrust of my argument. It just misunderstands the family to characterize it simply as a locus of affective good, and not as an association that is motivated by rational interest. And I think parents, insofar as they're naturally oriented to you see this child with all kinds of potential, and you love the child that you have, regardless of what particular skills or abilities they have. But at the same time, you see that they have all of this potential, including a rational capacity that you watch develop bit by bit as they, you know, as they ask more questions about the world, begin to ask questions about God and so forth. And you see these things develop, and parents have a desire to see all of those capacities to grow and for their children to become who they can see they were meant to be. And so and intrinsic to that is a cultivation of the rational, irrational capacity. And I think reflective parents recognize that that, as you're saying, if you're simply trying to override rather than develop the independent, rational flourishing of your child, you're more likely to produce rebellion. And in any event, and I think one of the primary concerns for someone like Gutman is passing on religious faith. But any mature faith is going to have to be a reflective one that is personally adopted by the child, which requires the ability to think things through and understand the reasons for the belief you have. So in any event, that's the argument that I take, trying to, on the one hand, recognize, yeah, there are inequalities that have to be worked out there, but it's a misunderstanding of the basic nature of parental education to say that it's not fundamentally rational.
Right. What now, as you go further into the book, friendship becomes a central concern. Why is friendship an important part of this discussion?
Well, Aristotle said that friends can dispense with justice, or there is no justice is not necessary among friends. And I think what he meant by that is that friends have a natural inclination to seek the good of the other, to be willing to reflect upon the good of the other, and to act for it, and to sacrifice for it. If you have if you have friendship, then the affections are animated. And I think the important thing there is fundamentally that's the kind of an animation of the affections and a willingness to act for the good of one's fellow citizens is necessary for the maintenance of a free society. Because if you don't have citizens who are willing to act virtuously, but also willing to engage the political project of engaging in deliberative discussion, as Aristotle says in Book One about of the Politics, engage in deliberative discussion about the nature of the good and the nature of the just. If you don't have people who are voluntarily oriented to doing that, which I think essentially involves the affections, then you end up having to require justice by law, and when things are required by law, necessarily freedom is limited.
You posed that question early on, that what is the law's relationship to virtue? And the old question, can law make people virtuous?
Right, yeah. And I think, it's something that I give a substantial amount of time to in my interaction with John Finnis. The classical notion working within the natural law tradition, I guess by now it's evident to your listeners that I'm working in this book within the natural law tradition. Although I add on the final chapter kind of culminates leaning into Edmund Burke's political philosophy. Some people don't really take him to be a natural lawyer, but I think at the very least, his thought is consonant with natural law and can exist, and I think really helpfully elaborate a natural law framework. But in any event, so within the natural law tradition, the relationship between the law and virtue is understood that the law is an important tool, instrument. It's a blunt instrument, but it is something that helpfully directs toward citizens cultivating the virtue that they need to contribute to the common good. For Aristotle, this took on, his notion of politics was kind of had a totalizing effect in that the law could direct all forms of virtue to the common good. So the law's interest in virtue kind of took on a complete interest in directing all forms and all forms of virtue and all associations to the good of the political community. Aquinas, operating within the Christian tradition, makes some very important amendments to that, in that he really begins to develop a notion of private goods that are not properly ordered to the political good. So Aquinas will say, yes, all forms of all kinds of virtue can be directed toward the common good, but there are going to be some actions of virtue that are not appropriately ordered to the common good.
I was at a meeting last summer at a university on civics and civics education. And I was amazed at how many of the people there at the meeting regarded civic education as the production of activist citizens. And that one person said at one point that the idea of a citizen who is not an activist, I mean, actively working toward civic change, social change, reform, is a contradiction. Now, as I was looking, when you were talking about the common good and writing about it, I thought, what? I mean, isn't a person who works, who obeys the laws, who pays taxes, who has family, raises kids, keeps his house and yard looking good, raises his kids to be respectful, isn't that person a really good citizen? I mean, how much does citizenship require that one get involved in bigger civic activities than your own little private life, your family, your job, your house, your leisure fun?
Right. Yeah. That's something that I give a lot of thought to in the book, thinking about the implications of, so if it's the case that politics represents something that is intrinsic to human flourishing, so that if you're not engaged and connected to your political community, then you're missing something that's intrinsic to who we are as social beings. Does it follow from that everyone needs to be very involved in politics? And I think the answer to that is no. So let me say the reason for this, I think that the right way to conceive of what it means to be a thoughtful member of one's political community is to, as I was saying a while ago, to conceive of the political community as something that is formed and shaped and constituted not by not by this particular moment, but it's something that exists. It's something that exists generationally. And the significance of that is that I think that on a Burkean conception of things, which I'm drawing from Burke with this argument, and I think that he's fundamentally right with this point, but in a Burkean conception, as opposed to something like a more Aristotelian notion of what an active citizen would be, I think a Burkean notion of a citizen is someone who is embedded in the political culture and understands the political culture that they are a part of. So I think it's more important, for example, to be able to say something about the disputes between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists than to be able to say, be able to name who the White House chief of staff is. And I think also that another point that Burke made that I think is really, really important to this question is that he understands that our affections, the affections that we end up having for our fellow citizens, which are rooted in a shared common life, we can't expect to have rich relationships to fellow citizens, or even a kind of virtuous attitude and attachment to the common good of the political community, if we don't have well-formed, cultivated moral sentiments and affections for those right around us, those close to us. And so that if you don't, if you're not someone who is investing in friendships and family life and in building the relationships and associations in your local community, you're unlikely to be someone who is approaching the common good of the community at large with the right kind of commitment and affection for fellow citizens and commitment to the common good and a willingness to sacrifice, a willingness to compromise, a willingness to deliberate for the sake of the common good. You may be active, but you may be active in a very self-centered or a way that advances the interest of your particular faction, as James Madison talks about in the 10th Federalist. So I don't think that it. Whereas I want to say, yes, we all have a responsibility to be informed citizens and to fulfill basic obligations of citizenship, like informed voting, service on the jury, and so forth. I think that the activity in the community and building up the associations of civil society is it's the seedbed of real political vitality. And I think in important ways, this is something I talk about in the book, I think that rightly conceived, there's all sorts of activity in civil society that we don't actually we don't conceive of it as political, but a lot of it actually is. So I think that being involved in the Boy Scouts would be an example of an organization that has self-consciously political aims and a desire to contribute to the common good of the communities in which troops are where they're located. I think that participating in the Boy Scouts is a kind of political activity, and it's an important political activity. And there are all sorts of activities of civil society that actually take on that political character when actors are actively asking themselves, what is the good of our political community, and how can we as a church contribute to that? How can we as a family contribute to that? That's political action.
That's political action. Okay. Professor Wright, thank you for joining us. Let me repeat the book. It's A Vindication of Politics on the Common Good and Human Flourishing. It's University Press of Kansas. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate it.